Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Mornings are for mixing and matching at McDonald's. For just $3, mix and match two of your favorite breakfast items, including a sausage McMuffin, sausage biscuit, sausage burrito, and hash browns. Make it even better with a delicious medium iced coffee. With McDonald's mix and match, you can't go wrong. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price.
Ukrainians are fighting an age-old battle against aggression and domination. It's a battle Americans have fought proudly, time and again. And it's a battle we're going to make sure the Ukrainians are well-equipped to fight as well. This is about freedom. Freedom for Ukraine. Freedom everywhere. It's about the kind of world we want to live in, the world we want to leave to our children.
President Joe Biden's remarks yesterday announcing that the U.S. will send several tanks to Ukraine. We'll dig into this major policy reversal and what impact the tanks could have on the war. Plus, former President Trump will soon have more places to post his social media rants. We'll tell you which platforms are reactivating his accounts. Also ahead, Republican Congresswoman Marjorie Taylor Greene's ambitious plan to get to the White House. We'll bring you that exclusive reporting from NBC News. Good morning and welcome to Morning Joe. It is Thursday, January 26th. Joe is on assignment this morning. In a few minutes, we're going to explain what he's working on. And along with Willie and me, we have the host of Way Too Early, White House Bureau Chief at Politico, Jonathan Lemire, and presidential historian John Meacham joins us. He's the author of the recent book entitled And There Was Light, Abraham Lincoln and the American Struggle. And this morning, Willie, we start with major news for Ukraine and the war.
This is major news. 11 months after Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine began, the United States announced it will reverse its longstanding resistance and now supply tanks to Ukraine. 31 American-made M1 Abrams tanks now are in the process of being sent there. They are the most sophisticated tanks in the world. The Ukrainians also receiving the training program, of course, needed to operate them. 8 M88 recovery vehicles also included in the package. Those will provide the ability to better maintain the tanks themselves. The announcement follows months of requests by Ukrainian forces to bolster their defenses amid Russia's invasion. President Biden spoke yesterday in the White House Roosevelt Room with Secretary of State Blinken and Secretary of Defense Austin at his side.
Today, I'm announcing that the United States will be sending 31 Abrams tanks to Ukraine, the equivalent of one Ukrainian battalion. Secretary Austin has recommended this step because it will enhance the Ukraine's capacity to defend its territory and achieve its strategic objectives. Today's announcement builds on the hard work and commitment from countries around the world, led by the United States of America, to help Ukraine defend its sovereignty and its territorial integrity. That's what this is about, helping Ukraine defend and protect Ukrainian land. It is not an offensive threat to Russia.
President Biden referenced Germany's cooperation in sending 14 Leopard tanks of their own. But so far, Germany has not shown the level of cooperation that many other countries with less military resources have. The United Kingdom has already pledged to send 14 of its Challenger 2 tanks, and Poland has signaled its prepared to send 14 of its own Leopard 2 tanks. In fact, before Germany agreed to send anything, Poland was gearing up to go around Germany in order to get their tanks to Ukraine. Other countries have indicated that they could send tanks, including Portugal, Norway, and France. The New York Times reports a total of 105 Western tanks have been committed to Ukraine. At this point, Germany's pledge follows a weeks-long pressure campaign by many allies designed to try and get Germany to cooperate. Germany had tried to link the sending of its own tanks to whether or not the U.S. would provide tanks as well, Willie.
The decisions by the United States and Germany being met with praise from Ukraine's president, as you can imagine, on Twitter yesterday. President Zelensky thanking both countries, writing, quote, "The free world is united as never before for a common goal. Liberation of Ukraine." In Washington, reaction was similar from lawmakers on both sides of the aisle.
I was happy to learn yesterday and this morning that indeed both the White House and their counterparts in Germany are finally moving forward with these overdue steps. As I've said repeatedly, time is of the essence.
The bottom line is we need Ukraine to win, not just for Ukraine, but for the global proposition that you cannot by force take another country's territory. And that's what's at stake here. And I think these tanks will give Ukraine the ability to finally get to the point that we can end this war.
What happened is a big friggin' deal. I think this is a turning point. There's been a decision made in Berlin and in Washington that clearly signals to me that they understand now the only solution is to help Ukraine defeat Russia inside of Ukraine.
A little bipartisan agreement there on Capitol Hill. Let's bring in NBC News national security and military correspondent Courtney Kuby. Courtney, good morning. So first of all, how did the Biden administration come to this decision? Obviously, President Zelensky had been nudging them toward it for many, many months. And also, what difference are these 31 Abrams tanks expected to make in the fight against Russia?
So it's fair to say that the decision that the reversal really for not sending or resisting sending these tanks to actually deciding to send them was a very quick reversal. So as recently as last week, we had senior Biden administration officials telling us that the tanks were not going and they were not going to cave to any pressure from Germany to send the Abrams to open the floodgates for other countries like Germany to send their versions like the Leopard 2. But then that was Friday. Now our new reporting just out this morning is that there was a meeting with Secretary of Defense Lloyd Austin, Chairman of the Joint Chiefs General Mark Milley, and the President on Monday, where they presented recommendations and they approved this decision to send these 31 Abrams tanks to Ukraine. But there's a couple of things we need to point out here. One, these tanks are not going to arrive anytime soon. In fact, they are still in the procurement process, meaning they still have to actually be built or refurbished from other tanks, which will take months. The Ukrainians still have to be trained on them. That's also going to take several months. And then these things have to be shipped overseas. So these are a long way out. These are not for the current fight. But you asked what kind of difference they can make. It's not the difference that these Abrams specifically can make on the battlefield in Ukraine. It's a recognition that Ukraine really needs tanks for the upcoming battle. So if you look at what the situation on the ground right now, Russia is running very low on precision-guided munitions, on artillery, some of the things that they've really been using here in the last several months for some of these longer range fights. There's a natural progression here that the next phase of this is going to be more of a tank battle. The sides are dug in, particularly the Russian defenses, and the way to break through that is with armor and then with more of these mechanized units that we've been hearing about, like the Bradleys and the Strykers that the U.S. is also sending. But as I just explained, the Abrams can't get there anytime fast. The Leopards, the Challengers, these more than 2,000 other variants of tanks that are already there in Europe with some of these allies, very close in some case, like Poland, to Ukraine, they can get there much faster. They can be in place for a potential coming counteroffensive as early as this spring. Those are the ones that have the potential to make the difference here. And you just mentioned also, Ukraine has about 100 tanks that have already been dedicated to them. There are assessments that they would need somewhere between 250, 350 tanks for this coming offensive. They already have some in their arsenal. They've picked up some Russian ones off the battlefield that they've been able to work and use and add to their arsenal. But right now, because of this U.S. announcement, there's this hope that these other countries are going to start flooding their Challengers, their Leopards in as well. And that's what could make the difference in this fight against the Russians. The ultimate goal here right now, give Ukraine the momentum, get them the Russians on their back heel, and hopefully move both sides towards some sort of a negotiated peace settlement.
And Courtney, the subtext of everything you just laid out and the subtext of these decisions from all these countries to send tanks, many of which, as you say, won't be there for many, many months, is that this war is going to go on for a while. And this appears to be a concession of that by now the Biden administration, that they are digging in for a long war with Russia, and they don't expect Vladimir Putin to look for that off-ramp we've been talking about for almost a year now.
That's true, but you could look at it another way, which this could be. So defense officials who I spoke with about this yesterday were saying that this is a sign of their medium and longer range commitment to Ukraine. You could actually make the argument that if everything goes the way that there are U.S. officials and some Western officials are hoping with this coming counteroffensive and this goal that maybe Russia would acknowledge some sort of victory domestically and go to the negotiating table, if that all goes as planned, it's theoretically possible these Abrams would actually never see the fight in Ukraine by the time they actually get there. But it is definitely signaling that the U.S., or the signal that the U.S. is hoping to send here, is that they continue to be committed to the Ukrainians for longer term. This isn't the only of the only asset or the only kind of equipment that the U.S. is providing for that same sort of commitment that they want to show to Ukraine and the commitment to the allies and to NATO. And I could see us seeing more of these sorts of announcements in the coming weeks of months, these types of systems that take a long time to build, will take a long time to get over there, but the Ukrainians can use for, you know, years and decades to come.
NBC's Courtney Kuby covering the Pentagon for us. Courtney, thanks so much. So, Jonathan Lemire, we can kind of see these dominoes falling. We had the British Foreign Secretary on this show last week. He was in Washington to talk to Secretary of State Blinken and say, we're sending some of these tanks. You guys should join us in that. Then the Germans come along with the Leopard tanks. And then yesterday, the Biden administration announcing it was going to do the same with its Abrams tanks. The president yesterday said this was all coordinated. We did this in concert. But was there some pressure from these other allies to get in the game?
No question. And this is a lot. This move here, significant, is a lot about allied maintenance. And this was also despite the president protesting publicly yesterday. This is about providing Germany some cover. Chancellor Scholz was really reluctant to send these tanks. He had domestic issues at home. There's understandably sort of pressure there to not send those tanks. And the president, after meeting with Secretary Austin, decided, okay, we'll send ours, which will then trigger Germany to be able to do the same. Other countries can also then do the same because it's a German technology. So these tanks will be going there, but it's about maintaining the allies. It's also, to Courtney and to your point, it's about, this is two different tracks, or they're two different time frames. The Leopards, the European tanks, can get there soon, next couple months, and hopefully be helpful in the expected Russian offensive in the spring. But there also is the acknowledgement that the American tanks, which won't get there for maybe a year or more, that's because this fight is going to go on for a really long time. So John Meacham, from a historical perspective, though, it is remarkable to see there's some tensions on the edges, of course, but that the alliance has stayed together. This president has done a marvelous job making that happen, even some of his critics say. But also to the point where German tanks are heading across Europe, something unthinkable in the wake of the events of 80 years ago.
Yeah, I was going to say, think of all the words we've been using this morning. European tank battle, Germany, Russia. It's my kind of day, as Willie would say. Everything old is new again in this. And I think that one of the reasons the alliance is together is, I think President Biden's done a terrific job with it. But also, nothing concentrates the mind like a common foe. Mm-hmm. And Willie, in a different context, just talked about dominoes. There is a fear in Europe. If you are a European, your entire worldview is shaped by territorial ambition on the part of madmen, autocrats, who believe that they can project power for ideological and nationalistic reasons. And you lose things, right? European politics is about shifting over time. And I think what the lesson of World War II is that, in fact, there have to be stands taken or appeasement doesn't work. And I think without aggrandizing what's unfolding, this is an incredibly important story. And it's, you know, sometimes we frame it in, you know, one of the phrases was Biden concedes or shifts. I don't think any of that matters. I don't think this is a political story in that sense. I think this is a world historical story about, will the oldest kind of appetite, somebody strong wants something that somebody he thinks is weaker has, and you take it. All of history tells us when you do that, it just leads to larger and larger conflicts.
So this is probably a good time to talk about what Joe is doing right now. On tomorrow's show, Joe will be reporting live from the Auschwitz concentration camp in honor of International Holocaust Remembrance Day. Amid the new war in Europe, the Russian atrocities being perpetrated against the innocent civilians of Ukraine, and the rise of authoritarianism across the globe, and the increase in anti-Semitism around the world, there's never been a more important time to never forget, to always remember. And as part of the coverage, he'll have an exclusive interview from Poland with the second gentleman, Douglas Emhoff, who's retracing his own family journey there. And John Meacham, if you could talk about this moment in history as Ukrainians really fight for the safety of the world, but also the strength of our own democracy with, and let me be clear with my wording, fascist threats from within.
One of the great questions we face is, Is the period we're in now like the 1850s, where a dedicated minority of people who wanted power above all, in that case, a racial hierarchy, propertied racial hierarchy, and they were willing to sacrifice the union itself for that hierarchy? Is this that period? Is it, as you were just alluding to and what Joe's working on, is it the 1920s and 30s, which was a period of modernity where you had battles at home over education, over what's going to be taught, state legislatures trying to determine school curriculum, a rise of a second Klan, anti-immigrant sentiment, fears of socialism around the world, that socialism was going to come here, and fundamental economic transition. The 1930s gave us the bloodiest century in world history. And what we have to do again is learn from that. And what do we learn is that you have to stop these things early. And there's almost nothing harder than stopping something early, because people can always say, oh, you're overreacting. Right? Oh, you don't understand, this is just a difference of opinion. Well, sometimes things are incredibly clear. And history does enable us to be able to identify threats and react to them. And anyone can say at any point, oh, this doesn't matter so much. You're overreacting. In the way that I sometimes think of it this way, if the world somehow had come to us with Lee Harvey Oswald on November 21st, 1963, and said, this man's going to change history, you would have said, no, one guy with a gun can't do that, right? Or, anything, James Earl Ray before April 3rd, 1968 with Dr. King. Things change rapidly. And so if you don't stand against the threat that a democracy is a fragile, fallible thing, then in fact, it does fail.
All right. Still ahead on Morning Joe, we're going to continue this conversation. Also, after a 2-year ban, former President Trump could soon be returning to Facebook and Instagram. What the move could mean for the 2024 race and the guardrails of democracy. Plus, does far-right Republican Congresswoman Marjorie Taylor Greene have her sights set on being Donald Trump's vice presidential pick? What she is saying about that. Also, more new questions swirling around Republican Congressman George Santos. He claims to have a new treasurer, but the guy says no. And the Republican Party is facing a new contentious leadership fight. NBC's Von Hillier joins us with more on that. You're watching Morning Joe. We'll be right back.
Today and every day, Planned Parenthood is committed to ensuring that everyone has the information and resources they need to make their own decisions about their bodies, including abortion care. Lawmakers who oppose abortion are attacking Planned Parenthood, which means affordable, high-quality, basic health care for more than 2 million people is at stake. The right to control our bodies and get the health care we need has been stolen from us. And now, politicians in nearly every state have introduced bills that would block people from getting the sexual and reproductive care they need. Planned Parenthood believes everyone deserves health care. It's a human right. That's why they fight every day to push for common sense policies that protect our right to control our own bodies and against policies that interfere with decisions between patients and their doctor. Planned Parenthood needs your support now more than ever. With supporters like you, we can reclaim our rights and protect and expand access to abortion care. Visit PlannedParenthood.org/future. That's PlannedParenthood.org/future.
6:21 in the morning in Washington. Social media giant Meta has announced it will reinstate former President Donald Trump to Facebook and Instagram a little more than 2 years after he was suspended from those platforms. for incendiary posts about the January 6th Capitol insurrection. Meta's president of global affairs, Nick Clegg, says the former president's accounts will be reactivated in the coming weeks with new guardrails in place to deter repeat offenses after determining the risk has, quote, sufficiently receded. Oof. Clegg released a statement on the company's website stating the guardrails will include, quote, heightened penalties for repeat offenses, penalties which will apply to other public figures whose accounts are reinstated from suspensions related to civil unrest under our updated protocol. Okay. Clegg also spoke to NBC's Hallie Jackson yesterday.
So I'm not saying everything is perfect. No one is. But we're saying that if you compare it to the circumstances which led to his original suspension, we think the risk to public safety has materially and significantly receded. But that is also the reason why we are introducing those additional guardrails to discourage him from breaking our rules going forward if he chooses to use Facebook and Instagram again.
Trump immediately responded to Meta's decision, inviting him back aboard by posting on his own social media platform and mocking Facebook for losing billions of dollars in value recently. Joining us now, member of the New York Times editorial board, Mara Gay, and attorney and contributing columnist for The Washington Post, George Conway. Good morning to you both. Mara, appreciate Nick Clegg's confidence that the threat has receded. There's not a whole lot of evidence of that just yet.
None.
Reminds me of Paul Ryan saying a couple of weeks ago, I can't imagine Donald Trump getting our nomination. Most of us can imagine all of these things.
Yeah, I guess there's no threat to democracy. We can all just go home now. The threat has passed. It's disturbing because it really makes you kind of wonder whether this approach was thoughtful or simply reactive, wanting to get back in the social media business of having someone who has relevance in American society posting on your platform. And this is really, you know, ultimately these social media platforms don't, they're just not held to the same standards that news organizations are. And that is the central conflict. That is the central tension. I don't think that has gone away. I continue to believe, I have a lot of concerns about that. And, you know, look, Donald Trump's reaction was to mock them anyway. So the business decision here has to be questioned as well. But the threat hasn't gone away. The threats to democracy are real. Donald Trump has not been held accountable yet. And we continue to see political violence unfold. So I think they're going to have their hands full. And we have to keep a close eye.
George, it remains to be seen if the president will accept the invitation back. He was let back on Twitter. I don't think has he been back on Twitter at all? He hasn't posted on Twitter at all. We'll see if he goes back there. But of course, we know now, thanks to all the reporting that's been done, all we've heard from the January 6th Select Committee, that Facebook in particular was a gathering place for people before the 6th and to foment all the ideas that led to that day.
Yeah, and it's absolutely a mystifying decision on their part. I mean, I just think they think that, oh, well, the fire's out, so let's, even though this guy has a cache of matches and gasoline that he carries around with him, let's just let him play with matches again. And it's just, it's ridiculous, because if you look at what he says daily, day in, day out, on his Truth Social website, he's in a lot of ways worse than he was a couple of years ago. He's lost touch with reality in a way that, I mean, he always had little touch with reality, but he's worse today. You know, all the racist attacks on Elaine Chao, and he's just, it's not going to work out very well.
So, John Meacham, Facebook also provides a strategic thing for Donald Trump, who's launching his campaign. That's where he raises money. Yeah. So this is another step where Trump, if indeed he's going through with this bid and he's finally got some campaign events this weekend, Facebook's going to be useful there. Twitter was, of course, the venue where he propagated most of his most dangerous ideas. But he'll be back there soon enough once he figures out what to do with Truth Social. So how worried are you that he's been given his platform again, the place where he called for his supporters more or less to storm the United States Capitol and try to upend our democracy?
Very. George, mm-hmm. I admire his work. He says it's mystifying. I don't think it's all that mystifying, if I may, right? Facebook needs money. Trump needs relevance. I think it's a devil's bargain here. And I think that ultimately Facebook will be making a deal with the devil, and probably the check's going to bounce because it never actually works out. I think The marketplace of ideas has to adjudicate, debate, do we want a Trumpian autocracy, or do we want a constitutional democracy that, for all its imperfections, has produced a country that most of us want to defend? And that is a debate that has to unfold in the country. The better angels of our nature have won two elections in a row, 2020 and 2022, which was supposed to be a terrible blowout against President Biden. It wasn't. That said, if you're one of these companies, do you want to be the means by which an autocrat mounts an assault on the Constitution itself? And that's, I mean, maybe they do.
They've already run that experiment.
Right.
It worked out.
So the question, I think it's a moral question. There are financial incentives. I guess there are relevance incentives and all that. But it's a moral question.
Yeah.
Do you want this constitutional democracy to unfold, or do you want it to fall apart? And it's I hate it when people say it's just that simple. It's not simple, but it's straightforward. Right. I mean, that's the question. And we don't have, as George says, there's no mystery here. He's done it all in front of us. On camera. Mm-hmm. Right. I keep waiting for there to be like something secret. You know, he said it, you know, you got to fight like hell. You know, he puts pressure on Pence. Let's remember, Mike Pence stood between us and the abyss. And I'm glad he did. But it's a reminder of how fragile this is.
Mara, you made an important point. I think some of this probably is reaction to criticism that they've received, trying to be balanced. Well, he is running for president. We've got to give him another chance. We don't want to be attacked by conservatives as being anti-Trump and all the rest of it. So clearly some of that factors into this as well.
As though you can satisfy that part of the country or the electorate. You know, I think that's a fool's errand as well. But John has made a good point, too, here, which is that you don't want to, whether you're a company or an institution, you don't want to hand over the keys to democracy to have someone destroy that democracy. So do you want to be that institution that really helps take down the country? I mean, this is a business. So yes, it's a little bit different than a public institution, but we should still be asking the moral question. I mean, if this was years ago, we would ask moral questions. Do we want a chemical company as a chemical company? Should we be supporting weapons of war? I mean, these are questions that are not new in American history, but we should be asking them. And Facebook may not have, or Meta may not have, the same responsibility. You know, as a business, I mean, it has a responsibility to its shareholders. Fine, but we can still ask those moral questions, and we should.
And autocrats depend. History tells us, experience tells us, they depend on a short attention span. There's a great line in Tom Sawyer where Tom Sawyer says, an evangelist came to town who was so good that even Huck Finn was saved until Tuesday. Right? So we were all kind of saved until Tuesday, but now it's Wednesday. Hmm. And the idea that, I mean, there's no change. And there's also the mechanics of populism. You're exactly right. You know, when the Republicans talk about big tech, when the MAGA world talks about it, that's what they're talking about. And they're talking about censorship. Donald Trump is not censored. Here we are yet again of a day talking about him.
And this is Marjorie Taylor Greene, apparently, is openly mm-hmm. campaigning to be his vice presidential running mate. More on that later. John, I know you've got an important diplomatic mission.
I do.
That you're leaving for, so we will let you
I
go.
I do. Thank you. Thank
Please
you,
give
Will.
Our best.
Yeah. Yeah.
To wherever it is you may be going.
I appreciate that.
John, good to see you. Mika?
All right. Thank you, Meacham. Donald Trump's, as Willie pointed out, 2024 presidential campaign is still in its early stages, but one of his top allies in Congress is already reportedly angling to be his running mate. Congresswoman Marjorie Taylor Greene is said to have her sights set on becoming Trump's pick for vice president. That's according to an exclusive report from NBC News. Former Trump advisor Steve Bannon told NBC News Greene sees herself on the short list for Trump's VP. A second source who has advised Greene said her, quote, whole vision is to be vice president. The source added that Greene's VP ambitions are at the heart of an effort to rebrand herself as a politician who can work with Republican hardliners and its establishment wing. This could explain why she was so heavily involved in the push to get Kevin McCarthy elected as Speaker of the House. Bannon said her support of McCarthy was a power move with the long-term goal of being a player. Green's spokesperson responded to the report saying the Congresswoman is laser focused on serving the people of Northwest Georgia, adding that her committee work is a top priority and not 2024 rumors. George Conway, you know what? Anything is possible in the age of Trump and in the age to kind of reference back to our previous conversation where these social media companies have absolutely no accountability compared to other publishers. And Nick Clegg can decide whether or not our democracy is safe from criminals who want to rise to power and then abuse our Constitution and our democracy and promote insurrections and riots. I mean, that's kind of where we are. And Marjorie Taylor Greene, I will just put my marker down right here and say this is a potential reality unless people get their heads on straight.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, it's in a way she's perfect. Trump, Green, 24, a crack in every pot. This will be the sociopath party ticket. She absolutely would play to his worst instincts and play to the worst elements of the Republican base. I think that it's going to turn off the center of the electorate. But at the same time, I don't think it's going to be serious that she would get this, because Trump cannot take someone as a vice president who's going to potentially upstage him. That's why Mike Pence was so perfect for him. Pence was, you know, so much of a cipher. I mean, drink water when President Trump drank water at a meeting. He would basically agree with whatever Trump said up until that one day on January 6th, which could have been prevented if we had a vice president with a spine who had conceded the election as it should have been conceded long before then. So I don't think it's a realistic possibility, but the fact that we're even talking about it is horrific.
John, who knows if this will happen, but as Mika and George both say, would you put it past Donald Trump? He certainly has.
No.
He likes her a lot. He likes what she says about him anyway. But let's look at this from the other side. If you're the Biden campaign, assuming he does step out and run, you say, we like this ticket. This would be great. If the idea is to broaden the electorate and win back some of these suburban women, say, that you lost in 2022 and 2020, I'm not so sure this is the way to do it.
When Marjorie Taylor Greene was appointed to some of the top committees in the House, West Wing aides were literally high-fiving each other because they know that she can be painted as the sort of symbol of this new Republican Congress, radical out there, a 9/11 truther on the Homeland Security Committee. That would just be quadrupled if she were put on Donald Trump's ticket as his vice president. It's already mission accomplished for her. The more she is talked about, the more of a celebrity she becomes on the political right, the more fundraising she can do. She's already a force in the Republican Party. The Biden White House doesn't have to do that. She's already there as someone who is going to have some weight. It would certainly seem unlikely that she would be a VP pick, even though Georgia, of course, looms large on the Electoral College map in 2024. I'm just amused by how Marjorie Taylor Greene's aides and allies are putting out this idea that she can be the bridge between the radical right and the more mainstream Republicans.
Yes.
I'm curious as to how she, who believes in Jewish space lasers, can be any part of the mainstream Republican Party.
No, I wouldn't. I would not do any high fives. Anybody in the Democratic Party in the White House, just keep your head down. These people are dangerous. The Republican National Committee has kicked off its three-day winter meeting in Southern California with a vote set to take place tomorrow to select its leader, third-term chairwoman Ronna McDaniel, who was handpicked by then-President Donald Trump, is seeking another two-year term. But she's got some competition following the GOP's, let's just say, lackluster performance in last year's midterms, but they lost a lot. Joining us with more from Dana Point, California, NBC News correspondent Vaughn Hilliard. Vaughn, what's going on?
Yeah, good morning, Mika. I mean, we're talking about the direction of the Republican Party, and all that is playing out in real time here. To give you an idea, we're talking about a body of, you know, super activists turned party leaders that are going to have a vote here tomorrow to determine who the next RNC chair is. Ronna McDaniel is going for a fourth term, and nobody would suggest that she has been anything short of loyal to the likes of Donald Trump, but she is being challenged by Harmeet Dhillon. Now, who is Harmeet Dhillon? She is not a what you would call a moderating force who is looking to go in a different direction of the old Republican Party. Harmeet Dhillon is been propped up by the likes of Tucker Carlson. And last night, she was in the lobby of where this RNC winter meeting is at, standing alongside Carrie Lake. And I had the chance to ask Harmeet Dhillon some questions and Carrie Lake some questions, who is still suggesting that she should be governor right now, as a side note. But for Harmeet Dhillon, her emphatic point here is that Ronna McDaniel has not fought enough for election integrity, and says that the Republican Party needs to, go and fight on the legal front more on behalf of candidates like Carrie Lake, who have called into question the election. Now, there is one third person who is also in this race, yet is having trouble gathering enough support. And that would be Mike Lindell, the MyPillow CEO. He is here as well. But this is ultimately going to be the decision of these RNC committee men and women. There are three from each state. And you've seen exceedingly over the years, those individuals transform from sort of the Romney side of the Republican Party, the McCain side of the Republican Party, to being Trump loyalists. And that is why yesterday, one other interesting person who was hanging around the meeting was the likes of now former Governor Asa Hutchinson, who is openly mulling a run for the presidency. And I asked him why he was there here for the RNC meeting. And he said that he is making the case directly to these members, looking ahead toward their primary process and pleading with them to make the presidential primary process a fair one. That includes debates. That includes the delegate selection process here. And so we are talking about in real time, happening right now, the Republicans crafting what their presidential primary process will look like, and whether, in the words of Asa Hutchinson, they're open to having a course correction.
Vaughn, it's amazing just sitting here. We've had to, with a straight face, talk about this space laser congresswoman being vice president and the MyPillow infomercial guy being the head of the RNC. These are real things that are out there right now. Is there a sense there? Is there any learning from what happened in 2022? We're hearing about Carrie Lake. She still claims she won an election that she lost. Is there any learning? Is there any looking in the mirror and saying, okay, we've got to do something a little different if we want things to change in our party? Or are they still tethered to Donald Trump the way they've been the last few years?
No, you're not seeing the likes of Ronna McDaniel or anybody step away from Donald Trump, to be clear. In the case of Harmeet Dhillon, the question I put to her was, did she feel like the losses of 2022 were because of the ideological positions of the Republican candidates were running, or because of the way in which the RNC was structured and the way that it went about its business as a political party backing its candidates? And she said it was the latter, that ultimately the party was not using its money enough to go and support those Republican candidates. And that is why, again, she was standing next to Carrie Lake, as Carrie Lake was making the case that there was an injection of 325,000 ballots that swayed the election against her here. And so there's not an acknowledgement that the party needs to shift more toward a moderate base here. That is not where we are at. Mike Lindell is somebody who is openly invited here to the RNC meeting. But instead, this is one where you're talking to members who believe that, you know, Donald Trump was a winning figure in this Republican Party, that he was able to galvanize a whole new base of support around the country. And still, despite these recent losses, they're not willing to alienate. And when you look at Republican primary voters, Republican primary voters have yet to display that they're looking for something otherwise. Does that mean the general election is different? Sure. But then in terms of where this Republican activism is here, it is still very much around the likes of a Donald Trump. And now the question here is, will that presidential primary process really be open to the likes of other individuals like Ron DeSantis, like an Asa Hutchinson? Those are the questions that we're looking at here over the next 24 hours.
NBC's Vaughn Hilliard covering the RNC winter meeting in Dana Point, California. Vaughn, thanks so much. George Conway, you've been sitting listening to all of that. You think there might be some learning given what happened in 2020, what happened just 2 months ago on Election Day in 2022 when they expected a red wave and actually lost a seat in the Senate and just barely eked out the House and losing some important governor's races as well. Do you see any force within your party, your former party? I can't remember if you're still in it. Of swinging back, of the pendulum coming back and saying, hey, we need to move away from some of this stuff and start winning again?
No, because it's all about the internal politics of the party. And that's what you're seeing with Harmeet Dhillon's challenge from the right. It's all about appealing to the right piece, the right-hand side of the Republican Party, which is what, for example, Ron DeSantis, if he ever runs for president, I don't know that he will run for president this year or next year, he's going to attack Trump from the right if he runs against Trump. And it's all about the internal politics and about control of the institutions of the Republican Party, and it's without regard to whether or not the Republican Party actually becomes a successful governing party, because it no longer is a successful governing party, and most of the people who are the activists of the Republican Party don't actually care about governance.
George Conway, thank you very much for being on this morning. And coming up on Morning Joe, there are new details this morning surrounding the shooting of a Virginia school teacher by her 6-year-old student. We'll explain why an attorney for the teacher says school officials could have prevented the tragedy. Plus, if the baby boom created modern America, where will power, wealth, and politics shift when it ends? That conversation is straight ahead on Morning Joe. We have no choice but to carry on. The fortunes of fables are able.
Now witness the quickness with which... MSNBC is going to be live here all night.
Today's news requires more facts.
Palestinians and Israelis are blaming each other for the tragedy that has inflamed the region.
More analysis.
Most of the states with the worst rates of gun deaths are ones where Republicans control the state government.
And more perspective.
This is not just about women and pregnant people in Texas. This is about people across this country.
The world's never been harder to understand. That's why it's never been more important to try. MSNBC. Understand more. Get the best of MSNBC all in one place every day with the MSNBC Daily Newsletter. Each morning in your inbox, you'll find expert analysis, video highlights of your favorite shows.
Running for re-election is when you actually get your report card from the American people.
Previews from our podcasts and documentaries, as well as written perspectives from the newsmakers themselves. Understand today's news. Sign up for MSNBC Daily at MSNBC.com.
The hour. There are new details emerging about the Virginia teacher who was shot by her 6-year-old student. A lawyer for the teacher now says there were multiple warnings and that the school should have acted. NBC News correspondent Yamiche Alcindor reports.
This tragedy was entirely preventable if the school administrators responsible for school safety had done their part and taken action.
The lawyer for Abigail Zwirner, the first grade teacher shot by a 6-year-old student, announcing she intends to sue the Newport News School District.
They failed to act and Abby was shot.
She laid out a timeline of the day of the shooting, saying late morning Zwirner went to school administrators to report that the boy had threatened to beat up another student. But she said nothing was done. About 12:30, she said a second teacher, concerned the child had a gun, searched his backpack and, finding nothing, warned an administrator she believed the boy put the gun in his pocket. Then after 1 p.m., a third teacher warned of a student saying the boy in question showed him the gun at recess and threatened to shoot him if he told anyone.
Did administrators call the police? No. Did administrators lock down the school? No. Did the administrators evacuate the building? No. When a fourth employee who heard about the danger asked the administrator for permission to search the boy, he was denied.
The school district, citing an ongoing investigation, declined to comment on the statements from Zwirner's attorney, but confirmed the assistant principal at Rich Neck Elementary School has resigned. Earlier this month, Superintendent George Parker acknowledged school officials were warned.
At least one administrator was notified of a possible weapon in the timeline that we're reviewing.
And Parker is out of a job. At a special school board meeting, officials voted to remove him and appoint an interim superintendent. Meanwhile, students are scheduled to return to classes on Monday.
NBC News has learned the teacher texted a loved one before she was wounded, that the boy was armed, and that school officials were failing to act, according to a source close to the situation. The source said Abigail Zwirner sent the text about an hour before she was shot, saying the student said he had a gun in his backpack and that administrators at the school weren't helping. The source said the text, quote, showed her frustration. And Willie, I mean, this is beyond belief on so many levels. And I think that might be the only excuse for all of these warnings to go unanswered, is that it might be hard to even conceive of a six-year-old bringing a gun to school and shooting their teacher.
Maybe once, but if you hear it three times, you certainly check it out, especially if a kid saw the gun on the playground and felt he was threatened by it, went to the teacher, the kid does the right thing in tears and said, that kid has a gun and just threatened me and said, if I say anything, he's going to shoot me, and you still don't find it. We're missing something here, Mara. I mean, the school needs to come out and say whether this is true, because once is bad enough, but you were warned three times, and then you have the teacher an hour before she was shot texting a friend and saying there's a gun in this school and the school's not doing anything about it. This is unconscionable.
There's a lot of things that are disturbing about this situation. The first and an obvious piece here is that we are living in a country in which six-year-olds have access to guns. So we should start there. It shouldn't be something that, you know, oh, I brought something for show and tell and it happens to be a gun. No, that should not be happening. Now, beyond that, this school owes the community some answers. Yeah. And I think it's really important that the pressure is kept up on them, as it was on the Uvalde officials. When you look at any school, the way they respond to this, I mean, obviously, at some point, the police should be called if there is a student who is afraid of another student who has a gun. I mean, there are a lot of questions about what went wrong here. And we're not getting answers. And I think, you know, it's kind of you pull a string and you get some piecemeal answers, and that's just not acceptable. So they really should be standing, I think, in a press conference before the entire community and taking rapid fire questions at this point. Somebody has been shot. I mean, this is extraordinary.
John, it's literally almost impossible to believe in this day and age that a teacher or administrator in any day and age, but particularly now, given school shootings we've had, would receive a warning like this and not do anything about it. What we know about teachers, how great they are, and principals, how great they are, that they wouldn't look out for the other kids in the class. We need more information here.
Yeah, this is a week that in America has sort of been defined by guns, sadly. The mass shootings in California, the more we learn about this story, it is hard to imagine, to Mara's point, that a six-year-old could even have this weapon, bring it to class. And then the inaction in the moment from the school is unfathomable. And yes, at minimum, the school officials, local officials, town officials, they need to come out and say, okay, here's what we know. Here's what went wrong. Here's what we're going to do to make sure this never happens again.
We're so lucky the teacher survived and is alive. But a group of six-year-olds watched their teacher get shot in front of them.
Change their lives.
That's forever. We'll have more on this as we get new information. And still ahead this morning, a look at some of the stories making the front pages in newspapers across the country. And at the top of the hour, we will be joined by a national security advisor in the Biden administration for more insight on the major decision now to send American tanks to Ukraine. Morning Joe's coming right back. Just before the top of the hour on a Thursday morning in Washington, the baby boom generation changed the landscape of America, of course, with a huge influx of new people influencing everything from pop culture to national politics. But what will be the impact as baby boomers now move into retirement age? Join us now, national columnist for The Washington Post, Philip Bump. He's author of the new book, The Aftermath, The Last Days of the Baby Boom and the Future of Power in America. Phil, good morning. Congratulations on the book.
Thanks, sir.
I was just reading up on it, and it looks like you've spent 10 years researching this idea, this concept, gathering sort of your thesis.
Right.
Tell us why you think this is an important thing to study right now and what the impacts of baby boomers moving into retirement are going to be.
Yeah, I think that Americans today don't really recognize the scale of the baby boom. In 1945, there's 140 million people in America. Over the next two decades, there's 76 more million babies born, right? That just broke everything in America. You had to reshape your entire society around them. And that's happened, you know, as they got older, that progressed. They had to build schools. They had to get jobs. And now we've reached the point where they're starting to retire. And so we are at this nexus where we have this massive population of older Americans who've long been dominant force in American culture and are now, for the first time, really competing against another large generation, the millennials. And so we're seeing all of these tensions that are playing out literally in this moment.
So what's the practical impact? What are some areas you looked at specifically how this is going to reshape the country?
Yeah, so I looked at three ways in which power manifests: cultural, political, and economic, right? So I think political was the one that people really like to talk about. What does it mean that we have this older generation, much more heavily Republican than younger Americans? What does it mean as they get older and as power starts to shift younger? Does it mean that younger generation will continue to vote more heavily Democratic? What does it mean that there's a huge racial disparity, that the older generation is much more heavily white than younger Americans? How do those things play out? And then, of course, on the economic front, things like housing. What happens to houses? You know, baby boomers own a lot of houses. Does that mean a big glut in the housing market? There are a lot of aspects to this that we just only started to begin to think about.
And what about health care, Phil? Obviously,
yeah, right?
Huge implications as medical needs progress along with the baby boom generation.
Yeah, the expectation from one firm I spoke with is that it's going to be about over $50 trillion of assets transferred away from the baby boom over the course of the next several decades. But it's not clear that's going to their kids. A lot of them don't have kids. But, you know, people are living longer. They have higher medical bills. There's going to be a lot of spending on things like senior housing. I spoke to someone from the senior housing industry. He's like, this is our moment. It's finally arrived, you know. But there's a lot of ways in which that those assets are going to move to things besides just inheritances over the course of the next several decades.
There's certainly been some criticism of baby boomers. They seem reluctant to turn over power to the next generation. Talk about what, how that is manifesting and also how this could change as they age out. Right. The two political parties, how could they change with them?
Yeah, so I think this idea that the baby boomers have this aggregated power that they're sort of hoarding, I understand why that sense exists, but it's important to recognize, of course, the baby boom is a huge and varied generation, right? I mean, it's not even necessarily much more strongly Republican than is Democratic. You have a lot of individuals who own homes who are making individual choices about protecting their own home value, seeing that as a storehouse for retirement, and those in the aggregate then mean that it's harder to build new housing, and people are making decisions about when you build new housing. So those sorts of things sort of trickle up just from the scale of the generation. You know, what does it mean over the long term? I mean, obviously the book goes into this at some length, but I really do think this idea that America necessarily people get more conservative as they get older, I think that, first of all, isn't well rooted in evidence, but I think it also kind of breaks given how different older Americans today are than our younger Americans.
Can you talk to us a little bit about how the baby boomers did overall as they're reaching retirement in terms of wealth generation? I mean, I think that there's a sense that they may be the last American generation to maybe do better than their parents did overall. And obviously that doesn't break down necessarily evenly by race.
It's exactly right. And we actually, there's a chart in the book that shows how over time, it used to be the case that children did much better than their parents. But once you get into later birth years, that's simply not true anymore. First of all, you're right that the baby boom collectively has a lot of wealth, but on an individual basis, they are not particularly wealthy, right? It's not as though boomers themselves are wealthier than millennials. But yes, there are also huge racial disparities. And the fact that the younger generations are so much more heavily Black and Hispanic and Asian American than the older generations, that's something that honestly we're still waiting to see how it's going to play out.
You got an excerpt in the book that you've published, mm-hmm. talking about Florida being
right.
the perfect encapsulation of the baby boom generation.
Right.
As people retire, obviously they move down there, reshaping the politics a little bit.
Right.
What else do you see in that state that tells the story of this book?
Yeah, it's fascinating. If you look at the Census Bureau does projections for what America is going to look like. So they've projected out to 2060. If you look at the demography, race and age breakdowns nationally, what it's expected to be in 2060 almost looks exactly like where Florida is now, right? And so for a lot of people, particularly Democrats, are like, oh my God, does that mean the national politics are going to look like, you know, Ron DeSantis being president forever? And not really, because there's obviously some unique characteristics of Florida's population, including that the older population in Florida now is much more heavily white than the older population is going to be in 2060. So, yes, that's what America is supposed to look like demographically, but there's a lot of caveats.
It's so interesting. We've only scratched the surface. The new book is The Aftermath, The Last Days of the Baby Boom and the Future of Power in America The Washington Post, Philip Bump, congratulations. Thanks for being here.
When news breaks, go beyond the headlines with the new MSNBC app.
New developments in the legal drama surrounding former President Donald Trump.
Get real-time analysis from live blogs to in-depth essays, video highlights from your favorite shows and hosts.
Lots of news of all kinds going on right now.
And the latest updates on the 2024 election.
The rematch is on. It's Trump-Biden Part 2.
Go beyond the what to understand the why. Download the app now at msnbc.com/app.